Hello, come in. Lie down. Relax. Take a deep breath in. And now breathe out. We'll be your therapists today. You're listening to Triathlon Therapy.
That's too much time. Look at Steve McKenna. Steve, what are you doing, Steve? That's too much time. Advantage Reed.
Just wanted to say, Clint, sponsor of the episode for this one was once again First Home Specialists with Lee Anderson. Look it up. First Home Specialists, he is the master of helping you get your, get your stuff together to get a first home, get into your first house. It is easily the most life-changing thing you can do in Australia where the property market never seems to go down. No guarantees that that will continue that way. But make sure you let him know that you heard about us from Triathlon Therapy Podcast, because it's the only way he'll pay us.
One thing I will say about Lee's business and Lee in general is he's very good at communicating his thoughts. So if you are even thinking of dabbling in the property industry, get on and follow him on the socials, because he actually he dumbs it down for a lot of us dumb folk and makes it very simple to follow and very easy to digest.
Well, we'll kick off.
We're not going to push you down.
Kick off with this to start, because this podcast was really kicked off to help Steve's reach as a pro athlete, and chance of him coming on time is slim to none. So we're just going to start.
I can slag him off then.
He'll be 5 minutes away, and then he'll come on, and we won't be able to hear him and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, we may as well kick off. I don't even know what episode. Triathlon Therapy. Reedy and I are very excited to be joined by coach to a plethora of very talented professional athletes. He's a shaman of success, a wizard of winning, teacher of talent, chef of conquering, and breeder of wolves. There you go. David Tilbury Davis, thanks for coming on.
Good afternoon to you, and good morning to everybody that's where I am. So,
yeah, you've got us at a bad time, actually. We don't often like doing things without caffeine. So we've been talking to athletes all day. If we, it won't be, if we're yawning, it's not because we're bored of you. It's just been a long one. 6 a.m. swim squad. That's coaching fun. Straight through to now. And then actually we've got another open Zoom call with all the athletes after this. So we're hanging in there, but we are pretty excited to have you on. Obviously, I think I first met you maybe in 2014, and you're coaching great athletes then. I don't know. I'd really realized before this episode that I don't actually know much of your history in coaching, except that you've just been around for as long as I've pretty much been around.
I've been coaching as long as, you know, since McKenna was in diapers. That's pretty much.
He's still acts very much like a child. So that's.
I started coaching when I was doing some postgraduate research for the Ministry of Defence to do with like gate a load carriage, so like gate analysis type stuff. I was at Loughborough University, which is, you know, where British Triathlon are based. But I was there, you know, a long time before British Triathlon were even based there. But we still had a lot of folks there that were at the very sort of top tier. My lane one was led by Richard Stannard. My lane two was led by Jessica Harrison. So, you know, that you might remember them, Tim. You know, there's for listeners, you know, those are some athletes from sort of back in the day, so to speak. And that was just like a baptism of fire to, you know, coaching elite athletes. And I carried on coaching as I went into sort of a corporate lifestyle and job. I carried on coaching on the side with the club, which happened to be Leeds Bradford Triathlon Club. And that was before Alistair and Johnny were really knee high to a grasshopper. And then, you know, from then on, it just kind of grew organically. And it wasn't until 2008. that I then decided to coach full time. And I moved to Spain and just started coaching full time. And I had a handful of athletes, and it's always been that way. It's always just been a handful of athletes. So, and then I did about 6 or 7 years in Spain, and then 3 in Texas. That's when we met, Tim, when you were there with the infamous rap gate.
That's right.
I've got a good memory, and then 3 years in Seattle, and then I've been in Finland, settled with family since 2018.
I just told my wife to stop the kids stomping outside. Someone's like, I think my oldest is purposely trying to just get me into a rage. So yeah, talk to me about Finland. Like, of all places, why did you end up there? I do want to go more into your coaching history, but just, you know, now you've got young kids. What's Finnish lifestyle look like, and what's the story behind that?
So my wife is Finnish. We met in Spain, and then she came out to the US and joined me there. And then when she was pregnant with our first child, and we were in a situation where we had to decide whether we wanted to settle in the US and try and get green cards and all of that, or come back to Finland, which has social healthcare and the sort of one of the top education systems in the world. That wasn't too difficult a decision. So, yeah. So we came back, and, you know, and then our eldest was born about 6 months later. So
amazing. So 2 kids now?
Three,
sorry. And so you're in the thick of it. Do you do like any face-to-face coaching while you're there? Or is it?
I actually have 2 Finnish professional triathletes that I coach. They don't live too locally, so we tend to do like a face-to-face workshop every one or two months. And then with other athletes, it's sort of, I get sort of parachuted in as requested. It's an interesting one. You know, you've obviously got the whole sort of, you know, running a team of individuals and spending almost all your time face to face, or you've got the very sort of remote example. But what's interesting in long distance is when I've after COVID and after pandemic, I kind of thought, well, actually, hang on a minute, why don't I just actually ask my athletes what they want from me, as opposed to me thinking that they want me to run training camps or they want me to be at their races. And without fail, pretty much all of them said, nah, we don't really need you at races because we race most of the year without you anyway. But we would like to be able to kind of like bring you in for like wind tunnel testing, or, you know, like face-to-face, like concentrated work on, say, swim or bike or run. And so that's really kind of where it ended up. And so I tend to travel to a few races at the moment, some of the PTO races. I'm not naive. You know, I know that there's a need to continually have one's brand present and engaged. And I guess I'm at an age where I'm not great with social media influencing. So
with, in regards to you saying that you get parachuted in for your professional camps or to do specific work or whatever that may be, do you find that you come out of those, say, week-long, two-week-long periods with just a massive amount of information that you can go and work with for the next, say, 6 or 12 months for that athlete? Like, do you find out enough in that short amount of time to kind of get you through the next few months?
Yeah, I'll be candid. I've never been, apart from the 1 week training camp in Kona with Lionel in February pre-COVID, I've never really had anybody say, hey, come and, you know, like spend like, you know, 2 weeks, like a bit like Olaf does or Henrik does with Magnus. I tend to be more kind of like a couple of days. So we'll focus on the swim, or we'll do some bike testing, or we'll look at some run mechanics. We'll do some S&C work. But effectively we go in with a very fixed strategy of this is what we're trying to do, and this is what we'll come away with. So for example, a couple of weeks ago, I went over to Sweden to see Rasmus Svenningsson, who's fortunate enough to work on the technical side of things with a swim coach called Antonio Lutola, who happens to be the swim coach of Sarah Sostrom. So for people that know swimmers, she holds the 50-meter world record in freestyle. So what he doesn't know about generating speed and technical, and you know, the technical facets of that is not really worth knowing. But he also wanted to understand from me, like, well, how does that fit with racing over 3.8K? Because he couldn't wrap his head around that. You know, he's like, I'm focused on, you know, hundredths and tenths of a second, and you're focused on, you know, 45 minutes of swimming. So yeah, just things like that. It's very much like have a very fixed point of view of what you want out of that session, and then come back with the answers that you wanted.
And it was interesting, just going back to you, not athletes saying they didn't necessarily need you at races. I've also found when we go to races, it's the pros. I mean, you know, sometimes Apo is traveling on his own, so you can be a big help. But often, yeah, they've got their routine, they've got their rituals. It's not a huge thing. But are there any that you will, that you still make a point of going to in general? Like, will you be at Kona and events like that?
Yeah, I mean, there's things like Kona. Athletes have tended to say, actually, it'd be just good to have you around. Even if it's, you know, because I'm going to give a split on race day at a certain point in the course. There might be some of the PTO events as well that align with the number of athletes that I have there. Some of them wanting a bit more support than others. But yeah, generally speaking, at races, it's a case of say less, do more.
Yeah.
And that do more is just, you know, on a reactionary basis, like, you know, not that she did in Singapore, but kind of, you know, notionally speaking, Ashley turning around saying, I haven't got time or energy to go and take my bike downstairs to Race Ranger, you go do it.
Yeah.
So, you know, at races, it's more of a, from my point of view, I'm more of a sort of a concierge, sort of consigliere type approach.
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, coaching and you got to do this and you got to do that and think about this and think about that. Is that all that's done or should have been done?
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's interesting as well, because also what I've learned from, you know, just being around a lot of different athletes and also other coaches is when you're in that environment and you've got a lot of athletes racing at a high pressure environment, you know, you need to be able to switch your personality between what each different athlete needs. Some people want to talk more, some people want to listen more, some people, you know, want to just not talk about anything related to triathlon, some people want to obsess over the race.
Yeah.
And you need to be able to read that. You need to know your athletes well enough to know how to switch between that.
Yeah, I really like that point. I've found, you know, there's some athletes I can tell the last thing they need is more focus on taking the race seriously, and it's more about, you know, I'll just go out and have some fun. You know, like it's the most low key advice you could ever give before a race, or you're just trying to reduce the pressure. And then other athletes, you're just trying to get their shit organized because they don't know. They're just running around like haven't thought about anything. And then, yeah, it's some of the most fun part of coaching is actually understanding the personality of the athlete and how you should play that pre-race. Even that pre-race couple of weeks leading in, but especially those last couple of days going into the race. And I think that comes largely with experience with athletes, but also it's probably inherently in you as just being able to read different personalities. And I certainly see other coaches who I think miss that side of coaching. And I guess that's really the art of coaching. Speaking of like art versus science, do you feel, over the years, what's influenced you more? Like, are you very science driven? And then, you know, what component of it do you see as more of a, you know, working with personalities and saying the right things at the right times, or even dialing in which sessions suit different personalities or things like that? I don't know if that question makes too much sense, but I think you'll be able to try and explain what I'm trying to say.
I know what you mean. I'm always very evidence-led, I'm not very reductionist about science. Like, you know, we must be measuring lactate every session. You know, we must do this, we must do that. I do see value in a lot of these things, but there's also context. You know, I had a really interesting discussion with somebody that was from a wearable company the other day, and I was saying, you know, all this like wearable technology, you know, it's great, but as a long distance professional triathlete, you're training, you know, circa 30 hours a week, including S&C. You've got to cook, you've got to do your laundry, you've got to eat, you've got to maybe have a social life with a partner or family. And now you've got to spend 15 minutes every day tinkering with a piece of software or an app in order to get a bit of data that maybe means something spurious because it's based on an algorithm, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, that buy-in is hugely critical. And for some athletes, they love all that stuff. And other athletes are like, that they're just not emotionally invested in it. And that can be a drag. I've had athletes that don't want to measure HRV. They just want to text me. I've got athletes that see a great deal of value in tracking HRV. I've got athletes that take occasional lactate measurements, but have enough wisdom to know that there's lots of things that can influence those lactate numbers. And I've got other athletes that are like zero interest in the slightest in taking any lactate measurements. So I understand all the science, you know, all the oxygen masks, and all the monitors. I mean, I joked with Matt Dixon one time, we were having a chat, and he said, how many times have you experienced like lactate being like the panacea of success? And I was like, I think I'm on my third time around. And he's like, yeah, me too. And we were just kind of joking how things go in cycles.
You know? Yay.
yeah. So, yeah. There's almost context.
It's almost like the mainstream, not even the mainstream media, but it certainly does go in cycles. You know, the training trends just seem to do this big decade-long loop. And then next thing you know, we'll have the next Pete Jacobs will come along who doesn't do any volume and just does something else. And suddenly everyone's like, oh, it's low volume. That's the key. And then suddenly the Norwegians are winning. And we're like, we need to be doing, you know, crazy amounts of everything.
Threshold. Yeah. Crazy amounts of everything. Threshold every day, twice a day. We do wheat a bit.
Yeah.
So in regards to your, like, you've coached a lot of good athletes over the years and currently, is there one like coaching experience, whether it be a specific target for a race or like a whole journey with an athlete that really stands out as one of your most satisfying?
That's a hard question because everything has been a really good experience and sometimes the outcomes are bad and sometimes the outcomes are good. But it's always the process that's excited me. Even after good results the next day, I'm already thinking, okay, what do we need to do better? You know, what do we need to adapt, improve? Probably, you know, from a satisfaction point of view, I guess I would say helping Rasmus win Ironman South Africa a couple of weeks ago and, you know, giving Cam a good kicking.
We're all for that. No.
but that was very satisfying because I used to coach Rasmus in the past. He decided he's a doctor by qualification, so he's fascinated by all the physiology stuff. So we worked together for a couple of years. Then he decided he wanted to do his own thing because he just likes the idea of all the training stuff. And then he came back last year, just around the time of the Ironman World Championships. He got COVID, couldn't race. And we were meant to do Portugal, and he had a really rough time of it going into there where something just really strange kicked off with his hip. And we literally spent like 5 months, you know, rehabilitating that and doing like, you know, peanuts run volume and intensity by any stretch of the imagination. And then just we just had faith in like, okay, this is the approach we're going to take. This is the process we're going to stick with. And then we'll see what happens on race day. And, you know, you saw what happened. So, I mean, it's things like that. I mean, is there ones more in the past that have been really satisfying? Yeah. I mean, probably the most emotional was I used to coach a lady called Sue Hughes. who wanted to qualify for Kona, and she went over to do Ironman Taiwan. And we'd spent a long time, a couple of months, really, really preparing for that race. We had everything in place, and you know, really tragically, the weekend that she left, her brother committed suicide, and she traveled out to the race. Her family, you know, I'm not saying anything I shouldn't, because she's talked about this in interviews. She traveled out to the race, and then you know, her husband told her when she was there, and she managed, you know, to race and to win the race and to qualify for Kona. And you know, that's hugely emotional, because she'd invested so much and then had to then go through so much more the week of the race and the day of the race.
It's
so lots of different things like that.
It's I know it's very cliche, but a lot of the time, like, good or bad, when you're invested in their journey, from like whether it be a injury or just getting them progressively better, or they've got a goal down the track that you're invested in as well, when they get to that, it's just the best thing ever. Speaking of Rasmus, I actually, one of the guys who Reddy's coached previously, he, before that race, he's a real data nerd, one of our mates, and he messaged me and said if Rasmus does anything close to what he's been doing in training, he'll win that one, no worries. So it was there was a few out there who saw the progression and nerded out on it. So it was, that was really really impressive, that one.
And sorry, just still on Rasmus. So did, when he wanted to go do his own thing, I mean, I've been in that situation where, was he almost overcomplicating it because of his love of it, measuring everything? And did you in some ways just simplify it and go, Rasmus, cool your jets, mate, this will work, when he came back?
He and I do have conversations about aspects of physiology and science disappear down rabbit holes. So my wife jokes, if I'm on the phone for an hour and a half, she'll be like, was that Rasmus? But love him to bits. No, I think it was just a case of he just wanted to like put the pieces of the puzzle together himself. And that's fine. You know, a very wise coach taught me many years ago that, you know, the job of a good coach is to babysit somebody on a journey of success. And as a consequence, you don't own their success in any way. You're simply there to empower them, and at a certain point in time, they might decide to move on. And it might be that you've been trying to get across a certain message about how to take the next step in training, and you know they don't want to hear it in the way that you're describing it, and they go elsewhere, and then they go and do exactly what you're wanting them to do, but it's just been described to them in a different way. And that's fine. You know, that's absolutely fine. You know, I've been around the block long enough to know that I shouldn't take things like personally when athletes move on. There's definitely been some situations that have been upsetting, but I try not to take it personally.
On that note, is there a specific athlete that you've worked with in the past that you were just, when they've had that conversation with you, you've just like, oh, if only I had a bit more time, this is the one that got away?
There's an obvious one. I think, and I think he would say the same, that Lionel and I got on quite well, and we worked quite well together. But when we did, during COVID and then post COVID, when we did the Canadian Hour record, and then after that, going into the battle royale with Jan, it was really after the hour record that things started to unwind. Do I know why? What it was related to? I'm not sure. I'm not going to blame him or blame me. I just think that buy-in broke down, and that's critical in any coaching relationship. So
I think it's for many elite athletes, sometimes even when everything's going superbly well, you're in this mindset of, but could things be better? Or could, like, I look back at things now and I made some bad decisions based on more of a personality flaw than anything else, rather than having a good whole view of what was going on and, hey, I'm still improving, things are on the right track, I'm winning races, it was always like, oh, but maybe I should be including that into my training, or maybe, and it was just, you know, with maturity and now having coached other people, it's like, sure, when someone plateaus or when things are starting to, you know, we're not seeing the results, I can totally understand it. But as a, yeah, as an athlete, there was definitely a part of me, and I'm sure, I think Lionel probably will look back and maybe think sometimes the same way. He's like, I wish I could have just stayed the path on certain things. And, but unfortunately I do think it's what makes athletes successful, but it can also bring us undone in many ways.
Yeah. So. I mean, it's, I've talked about this, and I think it's the same for any, you know, elite performer, is, this imposter syndrome and this sort of, you know, anxiety. There's just so many examples where you, on the face of it, you see somebody that you think is incredibly successful. But then when you talk to them, you realize that they're like so insecure about how they've achieved what they have and continuing to achieve things. And you're right. It's the fuel that drives the bonfire of success. And it's a fine line between it being the fuel and it actually consuming the athlete. And so that's where you see real world-class athletes, is the ones that can channel that into, okay, well, that didn't go well, but I've, you know, kind of got a specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, time-bounded solution to that problem. You know, when they're already in that mindset like this, I've got one lady that I coach that comes from a corporate background. And although she's very young and new to the sport, she's like, her attention to detail and stuff like that is off the charts. And she used to be, you know, a top class rower at college. Some of the people she rowed with are now racing in Paris. So she's just got that mindset of, like, okay, right, well, what didn't go well? What do I need to do about it? And when am I going to get that fixed by? And if she doesn't know, and she's like, what, how are we going to fix that? And whereas other athletes will just let that consume them. So it's important to understand that athletes and coaches suffer that. You know, I suffer that. I just like constantly question, you know, you might say, you know, you've got a track record of success. It's like, but I haven't won Kona.
We've spoken about that a bit previously, Reedy, where like I think it's healthy to have that level of imposter syndrome, because you always just want to, yeah. I mean, the second in anything, when you get to a point where you go, oh, I've got this nailed, then I think you're going to go backwards in a hurry. But back to the coach athlete relationship, I think, and what we're speaking about pre-race, like if you can have those conversations, like if an athlete comes to you and says, oh, I want to know about this, or I don't think I have this in my training, and then you can have a two-way conversation about it, I think that's when the relationship will still flourish. It's when those questions start to become, why aren't I doing this, that it may start to go the other way. So
yeah, and it's very much that sort of being solution orientated, and like an athlete comes along and says, like, okay, this is what's happening in a race, why? And it's like, okay, right, fine, I'll go away and I'll figure that out, and I'll think through the permutations of what might be, you know, contributing to that. You know, is it the stochastic nature of efforts in the bike impacting on neuromuscular fatigue in relation to the torque and the cadence that you're riding at, which means that then when you run, you can't run at the cadence and the pace that you're used to. You know, it's just stuff like that. The athletes don't want to go through that deductive reasoning, and I think that's where I've just been very good at sort of reasoning things through. But you're right, Clint, you know, when that segues into, why am I not doing this? Or, you know, why are we not using this? That's when you get problems, or you don't get any communication. You know, that's, you know, when the communication starts to drop off and you're getting ghosted on messages, and, you know, now, and then you realize that actually, you know, you're just writing prescriptions that aren't really getting fulfilled. Yeah. Then you've got a problem.
Sure. Just a bit of change in tact. I sort of started out, and hope this is, the information I sent you is actually all put there by Danny. I just put some order to it. So I could, hopefully we've got this wrong, but I should just thank Danny for doing all the homework on this show. But I started watching UFC like a few years ago with a few friends. And I was like, this is disgusting, you know, like, and then went home that night and I started reading about different fighters' attributes, like their jiu-jitsu or their high level kickboxing. And then I started to get more and more interested in it to the point that it's sort of become beyond an obsession for me. And you, the rumor is that you're also coaching Paul Felder, who is I believe a UFC lightweight champion, Clint.
Yeah, I think he was interim champ at one point.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But,
Paul works as a commentator now. And I do coach Paul. I started working with Paul, at the back end of his fight career. He was using triathlon. Ironically, he'd seen Lionel's training sessions on YouTube and he thought that was crazy. Then he thought triathlon was crazy and he got interested in it. And then, so I ended up coaching him from a fitness and a physiology perspective.
Oh, living the dream. This is living the dream.
This is what I've been angling at for, like, I'm messaging fighters like, hey, I can help you with your out of camp training.
But I mean, I think actually, interestingly, I think the in-camp is the most interesting stuff. Because when you talk to fighters about, you know, what they're doing, how they're doing it, the weight they're coming in at, you know, the type of training that they're doing, it's super fascinating. And I work with Paul from just a general fitness perspective. And then he had the Dos Anjos fight at super short notice, right? 7 days notice. And he had to drop 25 pounds in 7 days.
Yeah.
I mean, and he did it. And then after that, I think that went the full five rounds. And I think everybody looked at that and was like, given that you cut weight in 7 days and you still went the full five rounds in a 5x5, that's almost like the equivalent of winning it. And obviously he didn't win it. He lost the fight, but you know, to do that at that short notice is just mind blowing. It's like anybody knows anything about fighting. It's like, that's just completely mind blowing. And so, yeah, I've continued to coach him now as he's taken triathlon as a serious sort of hobby. As he continues his work as a commentator. And then, funny enough, through Paul, I got to know Bilal Muhammad. And so I helped Bilal a little bit with some advice prior to his last fight, just on the fitness side of things. But it's really interesting because when I started disappearing down a rabbit hole of, you know, okay, well, what's going on physiologically speaking, I actually kind of started going off on tangents that I felt were related, like, for instance, looking into free diving. Because in free diving, you're exerting yourself in a hypoxic state. And if you watch a lot of UFC fights, a lot of the time they're up against the fence, pinned, or they're pinned on the ground. And so if you try to breathe normally with, you know, 70 kilos of muscle sitting on your chest, trying to smash your face in, it's quite difficult. So actually a lot of the time in UFC, they're operating in a hypoxic state. And the second thing was the lactate dynamics. I thought that was quite interesting. I kind of almost felt that the way that they were training from a lactate dynamics perspective was all backwards, in a sense that like they typically might do some sparring, like some group sparring where they'll just be like, you know, subbing in, and then, you know, there'll be a group of them and they'll be subbing in, doing some work and then coming out, recovering and then going back in. And in my head, I'm like, well, actually, hang on a minute. In the fight, you're having to fight with massive amounts of lactate built up because you're exerting yourself in big bursts and then trying to recover. So technically, from a training perspective, it would make sense to me to, when you're doing some of your training, to actually be preloaded with lactate. So one of the things that I suggested was get one of those assault bikes, you know, the sort of cycling things, with whole body things, which is just brutal. I was like, you know, do some sparring sessions, but actually, like, in between the rounds, you get on the assault bike and you just bury yourself for a minute and then get back in the ring. and then now try to operate, you know, cognitively and physically, you know, with, for argument's sake, like, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9 millimole of lactate coursing around your veins.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. I was going to say, like, I mean, I guess it's hard if they're on the ground and it's, you know, compared to if they're doing stand up. But I was going to say they're probably sitting at around 4 to 6 millimole most of the fight, if not, and then burst even higher. How much of that, sorry to bore all the triathlon listeners, but if you were doing, if you were in camp, how much would you actually do of like aerobic conditioning as well? Sort of, you know, zone two, what we'd say is zone two training or even easier.
I would definitely be using that to drive the weight loss. So the, one of the problems that you also see in the fight world is you see a lot of fighters put on a large amount of weight and then go into camp and be trying to cut a lot of weight and improve their skills. And that's why when you see them then fight, they're just wrecked.
Yeah. And that's why I've been saying to some of these fighters is, especially the ones that I see going into camp that are just so out of shape, I'm like, man, reach out. I will keep you so that you're going into camp without the stress of having to lose all that weight while doing the most stressful part of your training. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah. No, I mean, no, they're, you know, in that situation, the risk is that you're getting a lack of adaptation to the training. You know, it's like factually from a science perspective, you're getting a lack of adaptation to the training. And you're also, you know, you're in a glycogen depleted state. So cognitively, that's probably not a healthy place to be if you're trying to improve technical competency. So, you know, I would say for somebody like, say, Bilal, you know, he's fighting Leon Edwards. I haven't had a chat with him in the last couple of months, but he's fighting Leon Edwards in a couple of months. You know, he's always made a point of not being too far off fight, like weigh in weight. Now, the reason that some fighters come in heavy is they think that if they come in heavy and then they cut weight, when they then load back up after the weigh-in, they'll go back to being really heavy. And obviously, basic physics, they prefer to be heavier in the ring. But it's water weight and glycogen. It's not muscle. So, yeah, it's an interesting one. You know, funny enough, I look from a swimming perspective. Bilal like swimming. I got him doing a lot of hypoxic, like, you know, 3, 5, 7, 9 swimming. Just to work on holding his, you know, exerting himself and holding his stroke technique together. I mean, he's not, you know, he's not a super fast swimmer, but, you know, he can happily, you know, when I helped him, he could happily swim a mile in the pool, just go back and forth freestyle.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, he's got a basic level of fitness and competency. And I said, okay, right, we'll start doing some 50s where you just keep going through 3, 5, 7, 9 breathing, and continue to try and swim the same paces and just to work on that operating hypoxically.
The last couple of minutes of conversation have just justified the fact that Reedy and I can now go and watch plenty of UFC and just we can use it as part of our job. I mean, but seriously, what you've just said, like, I feel like part of our jobs is to notice or learn patterns or study patterns and then try and apply them to our task or the specific task that we're coaching people for. So, like, to hear that is music to my ears, and I'm going to watch more UFC.
Have you become a fan of the fighting because of the athletes you've worked with, or are you a bit turned off by it, or what's your take?
I'm not turned off by it. I've been to a few fights. I think what's interesting when you see them live is you really do, you know, you watch some of it, and I think you get a misconception that a lot of it is just really brutal, just battering each other for, like, you know, 3 times 5 minutes or 5 times 5 minutes or whatever. But the reality is when you go to a competition and you watch all of the fights from start to finish, all the prelims, all the finals, what you actually see is that probably 70% of them are actually, like, there's just a lot of grappling, like pinning each other on the ground, pinning each other on the fence. It's not like this Hollywood, you know, Jason Statham style stand-up slugfest, you know.
Yeah.
that people might think that UFC is. And I still find it fascinating, like you said, Clint, it's like that sort of puzzle solving deductive reasoning. It's still fascinating to watch in essence the chess being played, because you know you've got people that are highly competent at multiple martial arts, and they're having to, you know, think really quick across, you know, different situations. And that's just interesting to watch, you know, to see somebody that clearly is fighting and is just switching what they're doing. And yeah, that I find interesting.
How much of that, this is going to turn into a full year. How much of that do you think
podcast on UFC?
One more, Tim, one more.
How much do you think that is like a cognitive decision? I'm going to try this jiu-jitsu move. I'll go back to a left high kick. Or are they just doing it autonomously, do you think, because of years of doing it?
I think it is autonomous, but I also think that autonomy is counteracted by the level of fatigue and going back to like the lactate. So that's why, like, one of the things that like I just thought was a good idea was like this idea of like, okay, if you're gonna do really technical work, like, you know, when I said sparring, you know, let's say, you know, with Bilal and getting ready for Leon, let's say he's really gonna work on, say today is like, right, we're really gonna work on some complex like jiu-jitsu stuff, like grappling. So my advice would be like, right, when you do that particular workout today, in between the rounds of doing it, you want to absolutely destroy yourself on the assault bike. Because when you then go back in the ring, although you're not going full gas, you know, you're not going full contact, like you're just, the bias is more technical competency. You need to do that. You need to train your body to do that under a fatigue state. And I think the way that fighters have driven that in the past is they've just sort of blended those two things together and gone, I'm just going to try and improve my technical competency at the same time that I just do loads and loads and loads of just, you know, sparring work. And they do, you know, when I worked with Paul, you know, he was, you know, there were days where he'd do like a session on the pads. There were days where he'd do, you know, a session on the mat. You know, there were days where he'd do, in essence, a lot of milling, you know, they kind of going in and out and in and out within a group environment. And I talked about a lot of this stuff with Eric Nixick, who's, you know, very, very famous coach. And you know, he thought that some of these ideas were quite interesting as well. So
it's much like swimming, right? There's no point really adjusting someone's technique if they're doing 10 times 200 as hard as they can. You know, on short rest, you want to work on the technical aspect when the training stress is low, so they can really try and make the changes and gradually get that more automatic. And then, yeah, I guess build up the fitness, you know, that just hopefully starts to creep into their harder sets as they make those changes. Yeah. Clint, let's do two more questions because I'm conscious of your time, David, and I know you're probably a busy man. I was going to talk about, I guess, speaking of the UFC, you see it across all the sports, really. I think there's, you know, when athletes are testing positive for drugs, I think the number of athletes testing positive because of tainted supplements, contaminated supplements, is, I think, still at such a unacceptably high level, both from, I think it's sort of stupid from the athlete's perspective, but I've always been very outspoken on how I think companies should be made to pay as well, because, you know, us athletes aren't always that smart. And so I think, you know, the fact that you can have these supplements that are tainted and absolutely ruin someone's career is very problematic. What are your thoughts on this? Like, with your athletes, are you very, I mean, most of your pros are probably quite experienced, but are you very cautionary on how they should be taking their supplements? Talk to me basically how you would prescribe supplements and your take on tainted supplements in general.
So first and foremost, I tell all of my athletes when we start working together to kind of explain to me fully what supplements they're taking, and any supplements they are taking are, for want of a better phrase, NSF certified. So they're certified as clean supplements, not just any random product that you would buy in the supermarket. That's the first thing. Now, I've had athletes take something which isn't certified, and I've said you just need to stop taking that. You know, we can, the level of drug testing, that's a different debate, and the finances of drug testing, that's a different debate, but let's just stick with this. In terms of these companies being liable, I mean, that's an interesting one, because I've done contract negotiation, I've written contracts for athletes with sponsors, and there is not a single sponsor, supplement wise, that would sign a contract that would say if they supplied a tainted supplement, and that athlete, you know, got a ban, that they would effectively be liable for legal fees or loss of earnings. There is no company that will sign that contract. I'll tell you that now. They should. That's, you know, that's how the wording of the contract should be for a nutrition company.
Even,
you know,
certified, like, companies, you
won't do it. No, none of them will do it.
Yeah.
But the other aspect of it is if you play devil's advocate, is, well, I get your point, Tim, but what about the athlete that knows that there's a certain supplement that has a reputation for maybe being tainted, goes out, buys that supplement, has a batch of it tested, so buys like 3 or 4 bottles of it from the same shop, same time, same batch, gets a bottle tested, tests contaminated, keeps the other bottles, continues to take that supplement knowingly because of why, because the fact that it's tainted, and then if they get caught, they go, oh, hang on a minute, but, you know, I always, you know, keep an extra from every batch that I buy because I'm really conscientious, and oh my God, it's tainted.
That's actually a very clever way of getting around it. I'd never thought of it like that.
But I think it's dead set got to be like, I don't know about you guys, but for me as a coach, like it's a massive fear. And I'm the same, David, in terms of like, if someone's taking something, it's like, well, it's black and white. It needs to be certified, because just the reputation damage if someone was to do that. So I think if anyone was to be foolish enough or risky enough to do that, you would really hope that they wouldn't be associated with a coach and they'd be doing it completely solo.
So,
the problem is that, you know, we make this risk of assuming that the humans were sort of, you know, Dan Enfield said this comment that humans were morally monolithic, and it's not true. You know, you can have, you know, I don't know what you do as a day job, Clint, but, or you might just do this, but, you know, you could have a boss at work who is an incredible mentor. He's really supportive. He's helped you succeed, but he's shagging the secretary behind his wife's back and kids, you know, and likewise, you could have a boss who's a complete asshole, but he's the most amazing, like, father and husband. And we make this assumption that people are morally monolithic, and they're not. And so this problem of, you know, drugs in sport is, you know, it's always going to be a problem for coaches. And certainly from my point of view, it's one where if an athlete did test positive, whether it was an NSF certified product or not, I would be like, if you've tested positive, I have to fire you immediately. Like, absolutely, like, immediately, even if it was by accident, I have to fire you immediately. Because I had a situation in the past where I coached an athlete whose governing body's rules were, if your coach has another athlete that tests positive, you're not allowed to work with that athlete. So for me, from a career perspective, it's like, if somebody else tested positive, potentially I could have like 3 or 4 other of my clients that would have to fire me. And it's nothing to do with me. So, yeah, it's a difficult one. And do I think it's a minefield for athletes? No, I don't. I think it's just like, try not to take any supplements, you know, at all.
But then you have you do have contaminated meat in certain countries. But I don't think it's a minefield for anyone who's got half a brain. I think.
Yeah.
My son interrupted. You just have to. I just feel for the athletes. Sometimes I don't think the education is there for newer pros. Like, I talk to some age groupers that have just turned pro, and I educate them on these things. And it's like the first they've ever heard of it. you know, no one's reading the fine print when they sign on to, you know, the I Am True with their Ironman event. So I think a lot of the federations have a lot more role in educating all the athletes. I think the coaches are well educated, but there's heaps of athletes out there without coaches or without, you know, potentially without accredited coaches. And I guess when I was talking about companies being liable, I was more referring to, I guess, more from a regulatory perspective, from not necessarily like it just should be that companies, whatever you put in your product should be what you put in your product in general. And that should,
I mean, it can vary country to country. As an example, like if you live in Spain, I used to live in Spain. If you live in Spain and you're trying to import sports nutrition, it's extremely difficult because in Spain, as things stood when I lived there, any sports nutrition product is sort of deemed a pharmacology product and so has to be, you know, meeting certain standards. So there were a couple of times when I like was living there and I was like, oh, I'm going to just order some of this sports nutrition stuff from the US. And then it would basically never arrive or it would get sent back. And that, and that's what I discovered was that, that in, you know, particularly in Spain, that's a situation that might not be the same in other countries. But, you know, the regulatory aspect is a difficult one because I don't think it's as simple as having some regulations in place. I think there's probably a significant cost to it. And also
even,
a lot
even,
of these
even
products,
an incentive based system where it's, hey, you do get a fine if you don't have what you're supposed to have in it, or if your vitamin D is three times what the vitamin D is supposed to be, it's potentially dangerous for someone who's, you know, or just things like that, that I just feel like it's a pretty relaxed area of regulation in general. And I'd love to see it change. Yeah.
But it can be avoided by like taking as little as possible and having a well-balanced diet. You know, there might be examples, like for instance, for athletes in Scandinavia in the winter need to take vitamin D. Mm. But you might do a blood panel and they might not need to take it. So, or they might be female athletes.
I was just using vitamin D as an example. No, I think that's a really good take and interesting too. And I think any athletes listening to this, like, you can really simplify it, like you say. I think just use NSF supplements and if you need them. And I think Clint and I always like our athletes to get blood work done so they're not taking things they don't need. If you're getting it from your diet, don't bother with the supplements. And then the other side of it, as I mentioned, is just be careful. Countries that are known for things like clenbuterol in their meat, just take a few tins of sardines with you or something to get your protein. Clint?
I mean, it is pretty simple. At the end of the day, from a shopping perspective, you know, if you can harvest it or you can kill it, you can eat it. And that sounds a bit of a cliche, but it's you know, in many countries, it's just shop around the outside of the supermarket because invariably the aisles is where all the processed stuff is. So, but then you've also got the problem of like many athletes, you know, they might not know how to like cook healthy meals, you know? So it's an interesting point that you made, Tim. I think one of the things that's lacking in professional sport and in professional triathlon is actually somebody, you know, whether it falls on the responsibility of myself or an agent or a manager or actually just a unique role of actually helping athletes be professional. You know, somebody asked Chrissy Wellington at a conference, like a triathlon conference once, how many hours a week do you train? And she said 168 hours. And somebody thought about that for a minute and then went, oh yeah, okay, there's 168 hours in a week. But her point was that I'm trying to be professional every moment of every day and not in a sort of, you know, monastic Christian Blumenfeld kind of way, maybe, but many, many athletes that are new, that are age group is turning pro, they don't know about how to deal with sponsors. They don't know about, you know, that many sponsors want social media influencing as a driver of return on investment, even though that might not provide them with any return on investment. That's a whole other debate. They don't know about maybe how to actually fuel properly, you know, how to cook properly, particularly if maybe they're also vegetarian. So that's an added, they don't understand like the implications of protein needs, you know. So actually, there's a huge need for an education role within coaching, not just this is what you do swimming, this is what you do biking, this is what you do running, and you know, this idea of, and I think that's a big gap in the sport at the moment, is teaching people to be like professional.
Yeah, well, 100% agree on that. Clint, you got one final beauty for Dave.
Well, there's a few there, but the one that kind of stands out, we always put fan questions out, David, and there was a few that came through, and I think we could sit here and talk for 3 hours about all this kind of stuff, all the questions we've got here. But top of the fan questions was, do you think Ash will ever do an Ironman distance race? And if so, when?
I'll just repeat what she said in interviews, has no desire to do one currently.
Well, that's disappointing.
That's very smart, Ash. Especially when you're good at something, you don't need to do something else.
Well, that was, I'm going to hit you with one more then. Scenario.
Yeah.
You've been in this coaching game for a very long time. You've been very successful. Tomorrow you wake up, for some reason or another, you are not allowed to be a triathlon coach anymore. What are you doing with yourself?
I'd probably go away and upskill myself in something else. Probably watchmaking.
Watchmaking?
Yeah.
Yep. Attention to detail.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. I mean, I come from an engine.
If you get that cone of wind, just follow your dreams, Dave. Don't waste any more time.
I mean, I come from an engineering background and a design background. That was my undergraduate. Then I did postgraduate biomechanics. So it's kind of funny, actually. Dan Lerang and I have like very similar backgrounds, maybe different careers, but very similar backgrounds.
There you go. Yeah.
Well, it's been really interesting to chat to you. Yeah, long time fan of your work, and
cheers.
Very much so.
Congrats on all your success, and I hope it continues. I mean, it's really informative and helpful to have you on. So appreciate it, and good luck with dad life. Clint's about to become a dad, so anything you want, you got to give him one tip before you go.
One tip. Well, how old are you, Clint? If you don't mind me asking.
37.
37. Ah, yep. Okay. Yeah. See, you're like a stud.
I'll take that.
Everything's a phase. Tim will concur. Everything's a phase. And there'll be moments you'll be like, I mean, I just remember like I can remember one time when my eldest was like a little baby and, you know, completely sleep deprived, and I'm just holding him, and the only thought in my head was like, don't drop the baby. Just like, you know, I'm not even going to concentrate on trying to breathe myself. It's like, you know, my brain is like literally like my only purpose at this moment in time is to hold my son and not drop him. So when you get really tired, just remember that.
That will be stuck in my head now. Everything's a phase. Everything's a phase. Yeah. Everything's a phase.
Yeah, it is.
All right. Thank you.
Even the good things, mate. They
eventually they don't want to be around you, right, Reed?
Yeah, that's what I'm getting.
Mate, thank you so much for coming on, David. That was awesome. Spoken for hours, but yeah, that was great. So thank you.
I probably missed half the things you wanted to talk about, but
this is what we always do. We have a long list and then we just don't really even look at it. So but if you're getting hit up by too many UFC fighters, you know where to send them.
Okay.
I'll do it for free. All right. Thanks, Dave.
All right. Cool. Thank you so much.
See ya.
Catch you later. Take care. Kind of like half of it was UFC stuff.
That's
perfect.
If we didn't get it back on track, Reedy and I would talk. You know, and when triathlon's your job and you're talking about it all the time, we spend our Sundays talking about fighting.
I mean, I think when you talk to like people that have been coaching a long time, you know, I think just that whole process of problem solving
is just like
a drug. And so like one of the guys that I've spent time around is Dan Path, the track and field coach. And like when you talk to Dan about like some running stuff or something or some cycling stuff, he's like, oh yeah, I work with USA Cycling. Oh yeah, I work with this NBA team. Oh yeah, I work with this soccer team. Oh yeah. And you're like, wait a minute, aren't you just the bloke that coached people to like, you know, do the hurdles and triple jump? It's like, nah. Like his brain is like, he's so, you know, he's in his 70s and he's just like, he's world famous as this sort of deductive thinker, you know, around, you know, biomechanics and coaching aspects. And so there's so many sports that he's worked in that people don't know about. And I think it's just when you've been coaching a long time, that's what you just love, is just that problem solving.
Yeah. Sure. I remember Matt Dixon once said, someone asked him, what's your coaching style or methodology or whatever? And he was like, well, it's just problem solving really with each different athlete. And I, you know, even this week, my favorite consult that I had was with a motorbike racer and just solving how the hell he was going to hydrate for a 3-hour motorbike race. And
I almost wanted to pay him
because I enjoyed the problem solving behind it and the logistical nightmare of carrying that and rehydrating. And it was fun. So I can.
Yeah. I coached Landon Castle, the NASCAR driver, for a couple of years. So I coached him, you know, as a triathlete, but also in the context of, you know, maintaining his fitness for race car driving. And talking to him, it's like, he was like, when we do this, like Indy 500, the pit crew only let me have 1.5 liters of fluid in the car. And I'm like, wait, how long are you in the car for? And he's like, well, I'm in the car about 4 hours. How hot is it in the car? Oh, it's about like 115 Fahrenheit. Yeah. And I'm like, wait, what?
How are you like, thinking? How did you solve that problem, by the way? We might have to include this as a bonus bit.
I think you can definitely train the body to get used to operating in a dehydrated state. And also, you know, driving a car is not, you know, in terms of muscle contractions, is maybe very different to, you know, a concentric movement pattern like running or cycling. Mm. But you can certainly train that. And you can do heat acclimation training, you know, using.
So there was no sneaking in extra fluid. He was set on 1.5 liters.
Well,
no. That's very.
I mean, interesting.
Thanks again.
No problem at all.
I'll catch you. We'll both be over in Kona, so we'll probably catch you there.
Yeah, I'll see you there. Yeah.
All right.
All right.
Cheers, mate. Thanks.
Take care, guys.
Thanks, mate.
See ya.
See ya.
Bye.